NBC News Radio, I'm Tom Graham. Greece's continued participation in the European Union's joint currency is one of the major issues facing Greek voters today. NBC's Michelle Caruso Cabrera reports many fear that a victory by parties that have vowed to cancel the country's bailout agreements could see Greece forced out of the euro.
And economists say if that happens, they fear the financial ripple effects will be felt all over the world, even in the United States.
Now, they're also voting in France today, where President Francois Hollande is hoping his Socialist Party emerges with an absolute majority in parliament. Fire crews in northern Colorado are facing powerful winds as they battle the High Park fire. More than 180 homes have already been destroyed.
I didn't think that it could really get to our house. I didn't think that was really possible.
It's kind of scary because we're not sure what's going to happen. And so we're just kind of like waiting.
The blaze has charred 85 square miles. This is NBC News Radio. Activists say Syrian troops have intensified their shelling of the rebel-held neighborhoods in the central city of Homs. UN observers suspended operations there yesterday. There's an increasing interest in the use of drones, but not in Yemen or Afghanistan, but inside the U.S.
Reports say thousands of drones may start buzzing around the U.S., peering from the sky at things like breaches in border security, wildfires, patches of marijuana growing illegally, or those polluting the land, air, or water illegally. The Christian Science Monitor reports by some government estimates as many as 30,000 drones could be part of intelligence gathering and law enforcement in the U.S. within the next 10 years. Scott Carr, NBC News Radio.
The top of the U.S. Open leaderboard is crowded heading into today's final round at the tough Olympic Club course. Jim Fiorenc and Graham McDowell are the co-leaders at one under par. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Tom Graham, NBC News Radio.
State Farm Insurance.
Are you the one who bought my husband a Falcon?
Excuse me?
You saved my husband over $480 by switching to State Farm, and he bought a Falcon with it.
How awesome is that?
We can't control what our customers do with their savings.
Stop buying him frivolous things.
What do you want me to do?
Buy me frivolous things.
Save an average of $480 when you switch your auto policy to State Farm. Get to a better state. Call 1-800-STATE-FARM today. Average household savings based on 2010 National Survey of New Policyholders reported savings by switching to State Farm.
Safe Light Repair, Safe Light Replace.
Ryan, technician with Safe Light Auto Glass.
So you think all auto glass companies are the same? Well, they're not. With Safe Light, you get more. Every windshield we replace is backed by a national lifetime guarantee, keeping you covered wherever you are. Plus, Safe Light has more glass in stock than anyone, so we can get to you faster. Just tell your insurance company you want Safe Light. We'll even handle the paperwork. It's easy. A quick call is all it takes.
And I can just read on the plane without any problem. Like now, when I'm on the airplane and somebody has a Kindle, they either have to turn on the light because a Kindle doesn't have any light built into it, or they also have these little small lights that clamp onto the side of the Kindle that lights it up because the Kindle is not a backlit screen. On the other hand, when I go to the swimming pool and there's bright sunlight, I cannot use the iPad.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. May I help you?
Yeah, my car's entertainment system just isn't cutting it.
Easy answer. Get an HD radio receiver, 100% free digital sound, digital traffic, and great music choices from your local HD2, HD3 radio stations.
Well, what brands do you have?
Best Buy has new expanded HD radio inventory, Alpine, Kenwood, Pioneer, JVC, with prices as low as $120.
Wow, an HD radio digital entertainment center? Show me the way. HD radio, more radio, more value.
At the Jeep brand, we've been on active duty for over 70 years, in conditions you can imagine and some you can't. And like our soldiers, we never shy away from a challenge. So we'd like to honor our armed forces' outstanding service during the Jeep military event. Get $500 military bonus cash toward a new 2012 Jeep vehicle. After so much time and service to others, we're giving our soldiers the recognition they deserve. Jeep.
Hurry into your local Jeep dealer. Or visit Jeep.com for the special military offer, along with other great incentives on the full line of legendary Jeep vehicles. Offer available to active military and military reserve, and to retired military and military reserve, with honorable discharge and 20 years of service within 6 months of discharge date on a retail purchase or lease. Excludes SRT models. See dealer for details. Jeep is a registered trademark of Chrysler Group, LLC.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Chris LeGrand, who's the president and CEO of Futures Group, David Steiner, president of DNR International, Bill Smedberg, the president of Pingtone Communications, and Tony Cancelosi, the president and CEO of the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. First up is a young man by the name of Chris LeGrand, the president and CEO of Futures Group. What is Futures Group, Chris?
So Futures Group is a global health consulting company, and we get contracts from the developed countries to go into developing countries and help those governments with their health programs for their citizens.
So say just a little bit more about that. On your website, you talk about the promoting and the protecting of wellness for these constituents.
Sure. We do a lot of work in HIV/AIDS and other infectious disease, so we help those governments and those citizens protect from further transmission of HIV and be able to get on treatments to be able to prolong their life.
So is part of it educational and part of it the delivery of the service itself?
Definitely. Part of what we have to do is really help educate the population and educate governments on good public health practices for their citizens and long-term prevention mechanisms.
Right. How long has the company been around?
40 years.
And how big or small are you today?
We're about $75 million in revenue.
And how are you funded primarily?
We mostly get contracts from the U.S. government and the British government, and then we also get some projects from foundations, private mm-hmm. foundations.
How did you come to be associated with the firm?
It's a little bit of a convoluted story, but the company that I was with before acquired Futures Group back in 2005, and so it was part of a portfolio of companies that we managed. And then we sold our whole organization in 2007, and then I led a management buyout of Futures Group back to be an independent company back in 2008.
Why did you do that?
Because I love and am passionate about the work that Futures Group does. And when you're able to connect what you love personally with what you do professionally, that's really a way to get really inspired about what you do in the work.
So that's important to you, to be able to have this alignment between the personal and the professional?
Definitely. Yeah.
Where did that start showing up for you?
Well, I have always felt a calling to be connecting people globally.
Always?
No, I guess not.
How young?
Well, my father did a lot of travel when I was young, so I got to see the world through his eyes uh-huh. As he traveled around. But then in 1994, I took a trip with 50 of my closest choir friends to Russia and just was really transformed. It was a life-changing event to be able to stay with Russian families and see how they live and see how they love their children and how they cry and laugh together. And it was really transformational for me to get that sort of connection with people around the world.
And because of that experience, what key decision did you make that influenced the way you are in business?
What I saw in connecting people is that ultimately all people care about certain things, whether they live in Russia or Ghana or Tanzania or wherever around the world, and that there are some common elements that connect us together. And so if we can find those and be able to pull those things together, that we can actually make it a safer and better place to live.
What were you doing before the Futures Group? And the buyout, I mean, all that.
Yeah,
take us back to the beginning of time.
So I worked originally for a firm up here in the Washington, D.C. area. Started my career up here in government contracting. So it's government contracting is in my blood. It's something I've always known. And then went down to North Carolina, to be with a small firm there, and we grew that. And as part of that, we ended up acquiring Futures Group.
Uh-huh.
So why healthcare? Why was that appealing for you personally?
Yeah, good question. Early in my career, I was an analytical statistician, analyst. Early in my career, I saw, though, I started to see in the healthcare industry how arcane things were around data and information, being able to use that to make better decisions for people's health. So I started doing, in the early 90s, started working on health information, health knowledge issues, taking information and turning that into knowledge to make better health decisions for people.
Where did the analytic piece come from?
My undergraduate's in mathematics and statistics, and probably can trace that back to my mother, who was a mathematics professor.
So again, this alignment between the personal and the professional, this analytical with this personal desire for the good.
Yep.
Wow. Tell us about is there a significant or one highlight moment or project that really comes to mind that just really is the icing on the cake for you?
Well, it would have to be some work that we do in India. India is a very special place to me. My wife and I actually support a local nonprofit in India that does a lot of social work. And we've been working in India on a professional level to be able to help the public sector, the government of India, connect with the private sector in health. The healthcare infrastructure on the public sector side in India is really pretty bad, but the private sector is actually quite good. So if we can figure out ways to have them partner to be able to deliver better health to the billion Indians in India, so that's a fascinating project to me, and also connects the personal and professional again in my life. So I get to go to India now on business, and I also go down and get to see my friends in South India.
How do you spend the bulk of your day currently?
Well, when I'm not commuting from North Carolina to Washington, I try to spend a lot of time with our staff and understand what they do, and I try to inspire my leadership team. A lot of what I have learned over the years when you get to running a larger organization is you really have to lead through other people. So try to inspire them and help them be the best they can be. I also spend a fair amount of time out with clients and partners. And then I do travel abroad a good bit, and I try to go and see our staff in the field and really be a support to them and really affirm what they're doing out in the field.
This notion of inspiring someone, how do you know you've done that?
Sometimes you can see it in their eyes. Sometimes you can see it in the results they produce. And sometimes that's a short-term thing, and sometimes you just never really know. But you hope and believe that the things that you're doing ultimately matter to people, and that if you are authentic and demonstrate real caring, that they'll see that coming through.
All right. Where are you from?
I'm from Greenville, South Carolina.
What was Mom and Dad doing back then? We know your mom was a math professor. How about your father?
My father was a textile engineer. He designed textile plants all around the world.
And how did that experience shape you, do you think?
The travel internationally really was just cool to me. When I was young and growing up, he would come back and, you know, we'd sit down and watch the 35mm slides for hours on end, but I didn't know how much that was really affecting me in terms of just fascination on other cultures and other languages and how people live around the world.
Have you always been this passionate?
Have I always been this passionate?
Were you this passionate kind of a kid just running around the neighborhood doing wacky stuff?
Well, I was the youngest of three boys, so I was a I'm probably a little more like my mom in that I'm sort of a bit more out there and extroverted. But that was partly just having to sort of fight for attention among two older brothers who, you know, had their own views around things and their own ways of doing things.
How did you make the step from being a statistician to being a business leader?
Great question. Yeah, the first company I was with here up in the Washington area, frankly, gave me a great opportunity. I was just doing statistics on actually weapons systems testing, believe it or not. And they gave me a chance to go do some work in corporate finance. And I thought I would just do that for a year or so, but I found that the analytical approaches to things actually did fit with corporate finance. And I stayed there 3 years in corporate finance and just learned an amazing amount about business. And I found that I was probably just an okay statistician, but when I could link that with business and people and how you lead people, that's where I got to be pretty successful.
Where did you learn how to lead?
I think that's a journey. You know, I don't think I just arrived one day and said, hey, I know how to lead. I think that's been shaped from seeing my mom and my dad and my brothers. And then I had a chance when I was at in undergraduate to have a leadership position. It was in a choir. And so I found that that just really gave me a lot of energy to be leading people and leading initiatives. And so it's really just been an ongoing journey. It's a journey I'm still on.
Talk about the significant mentors you've had along the way.
One of the early mentors I had was my very first boss right out of undergraduate. He was retired lieutenant colonel, and so you have sometimes an image of military, but he was a very quiet, caring man who really taught me how to lead people, taught me how to care about people both at a personal and professional level. And then later, in the last 10 years or so, I've had an executive coach that has really been transformational for me, the way that she's worked with me and can call me out on things when I need to be called out. And she's really helped me see my own leadership and my own journey in leadership in a new way.
So executive coaching isn't a new kind of a thing, but it's growing in importance and influence. Why do you feel it's so important for a CEO to have this type of a resource?
Yeah, I think it's critically important because you need somebody who will be honest with you, and you need somebody who's not in your day-to-day circle. Sometimes it can be a direct supervisor, but it's really helpful to have somebody with that outside perspective who can help you think through things and ask you questions, probing questions in ways that nobody else will.
Yeah. Are your mom and dad aware of your success?
They track my success. I think they're pretty proud of me.
Are they surprised?
I don't think they're too surprised. I think there was probably a time in high school that they were wondering what I was ever going to make of myself. I really sort of found my groove when I went off to college and started to find who I was.
Great. What's the website address, Chris?
www.futuresgroup.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Chris LeGrand, who's the president and CEO of the Futures Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, for helping me out with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. Good afternoon. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is
John Adams.
And John, what company are you with?
Pingtone Communications.
What is Pingtone Communications?
We are a service provider providing a hosted voice over IP service to business customers.
And what makes your business special?
Well, we provide a highly reliable and quality service to business customers where what we're doing today is unparalleled to a lot of the other service providers that have not been in our space as long. We've been doing this since 1999, catering to the Metro DC market.
Is there a particular success story you like to reference in these situations?
We do a lot of work overseas with the troops that need to communicate back home to their families, morale, welfare, recreation. That's a small part of our business, but it's a part that's important to us. That's communication actually over satellite. So it's been pretty rewarding, that aspect of our business.
Great. What do you enjoy most about the job?
I enjoy bringing solutions to customers that have an impact on some of the things that they're trying to accomplish in their business, and seeing those ideas and the things that we provide allow them or enable them to realize those benefits.
Wonderful. And how can someone reach you?
www.pingtone.com.
Wonderful. This has been John Adams with Pingtone Communications, and this is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, bringing you your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of David Steiner, who's the president of DNR International. What is DNR International, David?
DNR International is a firm based here in the Washington, D.C. area that is focused on energy efficiency. We call ourselves the energy efficiency market experts. We've been doing government contracting and helping to run voluntary programs that the government has run, including the Energy Star program, our biggest program over the years, trying to bring the link of government, utilities, manufacturers, retailers to helping to solve the ways we can bring energy efficiency technologies to the marketplace in ways that spur the market rather than necessarily mandate the market.
So Energy Star, as in the ratings you see on the side of a refrigerator?
Right. It's a label that you see. You have qualifications for those. We've helped design some of those on behalf of DOE, Department of Energy, and the EPA, and designing those for appliances, lighting, and other categories.
Right. And how old is the company?
We've been around for 27 years.
And how big or small is the company today?
We have about 45 employees.
Right. And you joined the company when?
In 2006.
In the role of president?
No, I was hired on as the Vice President of Business Development, and then also helped to manage part of the Energy Star program that we had at the time.
When did you become president?
In 2010 is when I took over as president.
Why you? Why were you the ideal pick?
Well, probably because I was the one that raised my hand and said I would be willing to do it at the time. The previous owner and the founder decided that he wanted to step back and offered the opportunity for a group of leaders to take over the company and lead it into the next generation. And so a group of us got together, and we have been buying them out and so forth. Yeah. And they were gracious enough to let me lead it.
Well, why did you want to do it? Why lead?
I wanted a new opportunity, a new risk, a new challenge in my life. And I figured this is a great time to do it. Still young enough, I guess. And foolish enough in some ways, but wanted the challenge to try to rally the troops and take the company in some new directions.
So looking back on it, what surprised you most when you took over?
There's a lot of things you don't know when you start into something like this. And I think as much as I thought I knew everything, or I thought I could face any challenge head on, of course, sometimes you're surprised by the gale force winds that may catch you at a glance. And, you know, you just put your head down and you push forward. It's not always fun sometimes, but I have loved the challenge, and I've loved the people that have, you know, pushed me along the way, too.
I love the way you describe yourself on the website, President and Primary Business Development Officer. Say more about that.
Well, I believe that I'm the one, if I'm going to lead the company, has to be the one to also be ready to go out and find the new business and so forth. But I'm not the only one there. This group has been a very collaborative group throughout its 27-year history. That was something that was inculcated in its culture before I got there. And we've tried to foster that along the way. And I want to encourage everybody to be a part of that initiative, whether it's the work they do on a day-to-day basis, or it's actually, you know, trying to engage with potential customers.
Everybody's in the business development role in your company.
Everybody gets a chance to do that.
Everybody
gets a chance to do that. And amazing to see some of the people that you would not expect who really do it in the most subtle ways and gain the confidence of a potential client in wonderful ways. Yeah. Just happened this week, in fact, and it was really great to see.
Where are you from?
I was born in Illinois, in the northwest corner up there, next to the Mississippi River. And then my family moved to Maryland, a little town called Union Bridge, Maryland, which is on the Carroll County-Frederick County line.
And Mom and Dad, what were they doing growing up, while you were growing up?
Yeah, my parents are both pastors. So we had a lot of experience in the community of being the preacher's kids, of course.
Well, say more about that. What's it like?
It has its moments. Mostly it's trying to keep your nose out of trouble because everybody in town will find out about what's going on, of course. But it was a wonderful experience in many ways because, as my dad and my mom showed, it's all about taking care of people and helping to figure out what they need and how to respond to that in very compassionate ways.
Do you think that shaped the way you lead now?
Absolutely. Not a day goes by that I don't think about what's happening in our business and how it's impacting our colleagues all around the company. And some days it's hard to deal with some of the decisions you have to make because you know what it may do. But at other times, you look at the potential that's going to happen and how it will enrich their lives, and also tapping what they believe to be able to take that to a new level in the company. And so I feel like I'm in some ways a shepherd, just like a pastor would be.
Wow.
Do you ever find yourself in conflict, wanting to be a compassionate person but having to make the hard decisions of a business leader?
Absolutely. It's tough being in that role. We've had some, you know, downsizing since I've been a leader in this. And, you know, I think about those people and what they're doing. And it's tough. I've been there before. I mean, I lost my job before I got this job, actually, at this company. And it's not something you look forward to by any means. But you also know that sometimes it may be better for them and they find new opportunities. And that's what I hope to encourage.
What's the most difficult thing you've ever accomplished?
Most in business or in just in general?
Anywhere, business or personal.
Wow, probably the most difficult thing I've ever accomplished is memorizing a senior recital on the piano. The challenge of that is not just to know the notes, but to know the emotions that go behind the notes, so that you actually present something that people want to listen to and feel the passion that goes with it. And I think in some ways that has been great training for me in terms of how do you run a company, because you can't just figure out how you're going to get the sale. Because in our line, it's providing a service. It's providing a response to the client about what they want. And they're trying to transform an industry with their energy efficient technologies and so forth. So listening to them, trying to figure out where the pauses ought to be, where the phrases ought to go, what the fingering ought to be. You know, do we change keys in the middle of the piece because it's not working out that way, or it needs a new version so people are listening differently? Those types of things.
How about the toughest thing professionally?
Toughest thing professionally would have to be just making the call when business doesn't go great. But also making sure that you're keeping the focus on what's next. It's not just, you know, the next month, not the next year, it's 3 to 5 years down the line. What are you trying to do to make this become a better business? We've been around for 27 years, and I want this place to be around for 27 more.
Right.
I may not be there at that time, and that's fine, but we're trying to create a culture where we will have something that will live on.
How about your proudest moment?
It has to be when my son was born. I did not realize how much that would profoundly change my life. I love what he's become. I love to see how he has to struggle with those things in life, as any of us would. I love the fact that I can let him be himself, too, as much as I don't like it sometimes.
Yeah. What would you like your legacy to be at the company? Looking back on it, what would you like to be said about you?
I'd like for people to say that I let them achieve their goals, and together that made us a remarkable company. And it's a response to what's happening in the industry as well, that those who are working to try to create new innovations, whether it's in programs or products and so forth, we do the same thing.
Right. If I was interviewing your mom and dad, would they be surprised at the path you chose?
In some ways, I think yes. I think they probably would have seen me as most likely to be the pastor in the family, from a spiritual sense and so forth.
You did co-major in religion in college, is that right?
Yeah, I was major in political science and religion, so...
And now you run a company.
And now I run a company. But I think that's great training in some ways for what happens in companies, because you have to deal with the politics. You have to deal with the spiritual side of things in some ways, what people are dealing with in their lives. I think my parents, though, would say this is not too different, though, than what that path could have been.
Yeah. How do you know that when you're interviewing someone, that's the person I have to hire? How do you know?
It's my gut.
What's your gut telling you?
My gut usually starts with a handshake. And if I sense a strong conviction through the handshake, that's a pretty good signal that this person is going to be a solid person. I also, though, in talking to them, are they giving me straight answers? Are they dodging and weaving? That usually is a pretty good sign that this is not somebody that I could trust in going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my gut.
Yeah. How about your management team? How would you characterize it?
they are as diverse as a team as any. They have they're all very, very strong-willed and have great creativity and insights. They're very passionate. They're very committed to their jobs and to the strength of the company. And I've been very blessed to have such a great team on our board.
Yeah. What's the website address, David?
Website address is www.drintl.com. That's drintl.com.
Great. We've been speaking with David Steiner, who is the president of DNR International. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and the chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners, who want to be better at what they do, and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at that. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Bill Smedberg, who is the president of a company called Pingtone Communications. What is Pingtone Communications, Bill?
Pingtone provides advanced phone systems and unified communications for small and medium-sized enterprises. Our typical customer would be offices of 50, 75-plus employees. And we come in and put in all the next generation hosted technology that allows for all the productivity features, the ability for companies to work from home, to have multiple offices, all seamlessly integrate and use all those new next generation productivity tools.
Give us an example of a next generation productivity tool.
Well, today, you want to have one number that you can be reached at from anywhere. So the latest thing, for instance, would be essentially your number would reach you at any device, and from any device you could, in fact, you could have access to your business phone. So you can turn your smartphone or your PDA into, in fact, your office phone, and it seamlessly integrates. So you don't have to worry about it as you're walking out of the office. It could be a smartphone. It could be your home phone, for that matter. Video conferencing, video phones, voicemail to email,
right.
All sorts of things like that.
When was the company founded? The
company was founded in 1999 and incorporated in 2001.
And how big or small is it today?
We're 50 employees, have several hundred customers, mainly headquartered in the Mid-Atlantic region, but with offices all over the world, and tens of thousands of end users using the system.
Right. And when did you join the company?
I joined the company in 2003 and took the helm in 2005.
Why did you want that job?
Well, I'd just come off experience in two companies where I had been in there, and while I had significant influence, I wasn't the leader of the companies. And in fact, both companies, this was during the telecom downturn and the internet downturn in the early 2000s. And I really wanted to lead a company to see if I could get one profitable and successful.
So you decided to do it at the most difficult time possible.
Exactly.
Yeah, what the heck?
So no problem.
So what was it like to take over the company in a very challenging time?
Took over the company, and there were a couple of problems. The first one was we had shareholders expecting significant growth. We were burning quite a bit of cash at the time. And trying to grow companies and conserve cash are diametrically opposed goals. So that was by far the biggest challenge.
Where did this ability to do that come from?
Well, you know, my background is engineering and finance.
Engineering and finance.
Engineering undergraduate degree and an MBA later.
Uh-huh.
So it was a challenge, but you know, something that had to get done.
I see you have some yellow jackets on your tie there. Did you go to Georgia Tech?
No. I have a daughter who's a yellow jacket. I was thinking of her this morning. I'm actually an aerospace engineer out of the University of Virginia, and I went back there to get my MBA later.
Where are you from?
Well, I'm from all over. I come from a long line of military officers, and as a result of that, when I was growing up, I moved on average every 2 years. The longest stint in any one location was probably 3 years. The shortest was 6 months.
Yeah. How do you think that shaped you professionally?
Well, I think you have to have some ability to make friends easily and quickly when you move like that. You have to, by being thrown into the new schools and new situations on a regular basis, you become less afraid of the unknown, I believe. So I think a lot of that has helped me transition from company to company or department to department within larger companies.
Yeah. What were you doing prior to your stint with Pingtone?
So when I came out of college, I did a couple of years in the defense industry, black project work in this area. Decided to go back, and that was a small cog in a big organization. I wanted to see the bigger picture, went back, got my MBA, came out and went to work for a Fortune 100 paper and forest products company based in Richmond, Virginia, and went to work directly for the CFO, really doing, if you will, internal investment banking for the company.
So leveraging your finance background.
Absolutely. So everything from preferred stock offerings and all sorts of financing work to merger and acquisition work.
What stimulated that direction? You started out in engineering and then took a turn towards finance. What happened?
Really enjoyed the finance piece of it. Obviously numbers oriented. In addition to that, I did like the deal making, the big picture deal making part of it. So really gravitated into the corporate development and the merger and acquisition piece.
Were you selling newspapers as a kid? Where did this come from, the deal-making piece?
No. I can't tell you where it comes from. It's maybe it's the devil's advocate piece of me. I am one of the things I do by nature is I can, if you want to throw a topic out, I'll argue either side. And I find that is a very handy skill to have when you're in there trying to negotiate deals.
Right. Go ahead.
When you were pursuing your engineering degree, did you think you would be going into business afterwards? Was that something you had planned to do, or was it a fallback?
No, I really came out of undergraduate in 1983, aerospace engineering. I thought at the time I'd probably go fly jets for the Navy. Really, the early 80s, the time of was a time when the military was underfunded, and everyone I knew who had gone down that path was getting almost no flying time whatsoever and said, stay away. So it was a dramatically different environment, and so I went into industry instead.
Yeah, you spent some time in the heyday of the telecom go-go years. Talk about that a little bit.
So I had just completed a five-year stint in Europe with the Paper and Forest Products Company and came back to the United States in 1996. This was really the beginning of the explosion in the internet and the telecom industry. So I was the 10th employee of a startup company here in the Washington, D.C. area. We quickly grew to 700 or 800 employees. We raised $750 million in capital and explosive growth, lots of capital projects going on, and then it all came to a crashing halt in the early 2000s.
Yeah. What was the role you played?
So I was the chief financial officer of the company.
So that must have been an amazing ride.
It was quite a thrilling ride, and very heady. We had the attention of Wall Street. You had the attention of big players out there. I was negotiating deals with railroad companies, with gas pipeline companies and the like. So it was fun.
What do you think that experience taught you?
Well, it was a little bit like stepping through the looking glass anyway, coming from a bricks and mortar industry such as Paper and Forest Products and going into telecom where everybody was talking about, a lot like Facebook or Google or something else today, where they were talking about number of eyeballs and you know, the total number of users, and really weren't focused so much on the fundamental financials of the industry itself. So for me, I had a bit of a grounding in a more traditional business. Walking into this was, if anything, to some extent, I think I learned a lot about about selling the hype of the industry and a little bit of the salesman side of that, where before it was, in old staid industries, there was a much more traditional way of doing things, even on the finance side.
What was it like for you to have to collapse it?
Heartbreaking. Nothing is worse than having to take a large company and make it a small company or a zero company. And after having to do it for the company I'd been working for, I was on the board of directors of another company, and they asked me to step in and do it again. I spent another 18 months collapsing and then selling off another company. So it was heartrending, and really what I was looking for when I came to Pingtone was something that I could, once again, take from the bottom, but build, lead, and get to profitability so that we would never have to do that again.
After experiencing the telecom meltdown, why get back into telecom? Why not go to something, more stable?
Well, it's an industry that was exploding. The meltdown really wasn't because there weren't a lot of fun and interesting things going on and new technologies being introduced. The meltdown was for entirely other reasons related to finances and the economy in general, and overheating to a large extent. So after coming out of that, I looked around the telecom industry first and was looking for specific sectors that I thought had a lot of legs going forward, and business voice over IP was the one that I selected.
Looking back on it, what would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is, personally or professionally?
Professionally, it's the toughest, but it was also the most rewarding and successful, quite frankly. In the midst of this telecom heyday, I was asked to go out and acquire rights away around the United States, and ended up negotiating a three-way joint venture, if you will, with two railroad companies. These are large monolithic companies, and a pipeline company, which is only slightly smaller, each one separately, and all of them closing on the same day. Uh-huh. And getting to see each other's documents on the same day in a massive closing at the end. And it was quite thrilling, but it took a long time.
Right. What's the website address for Pingtone?
www.pingtone.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bill Smedberg, who's the president of Pingtone Communications. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, with Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney, for helping me out with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Tony Cancellosi, who is the president and CEO of Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. What is the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind, Tony?
Well, I think I could start off by saying the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind has been around 112 years. We celebrated our 112th year on May 17th. It's an organization that started out in 1900 helping people with vision loss and blindness. To give them independence and help them grow, just like you and I that have vision. And they started out making pot scrubbers and caning chairs and helping them in every way they can. Today, we don't do that. We might cane chairs, but today we're a government contractor. We have independence living skills, orientational ability to make people independent. So technology has helped the visually impaired and blind.
And how big or small is the organization today?
The organization is about 135 individuals. 85% of that number are visually impaired and blind. We generate about $5 to $6 million a year in revenue.
Wow. And when did you become the president and CEO?
I became the president and CEO in 2005.
And were you, is this something you sought or were you recruited? How did you come to be in the role?
Well, I've been around people with disabilities for a long time and have been on a couple boards and chairman of one organization here in town that serve people with disabilities. And in normal conversation with people in my regular job in the technology arena, always willing to help people with disabilities and started to recognize the issues that we're faced with today of obesity and diabetes, which leads to blindness, that more and more people, and with the aging population, that we would have a lot of individuals that would have vision loss.
But you could simply write a check and make your contribution that way. You had to be personally involved in this. Why?
Well, one of the things that I found out a long time ago that when you get involved, you find out what your true skills are. And when you find out what you can really do, you can apply those to anything, whether it's a nonprofit or a for-profit organization. And so if you could apply your for-profit capabilities and integrate them into a nonprofit organization, it might grow.
So that's the reason why you wanted this
job. One of my objectives is to use the experience that I had in the business community and apply it to the.
So let's talk about your background.
Sure.
Take us back. Where have you been along the way professionally?
Started out in computers in 1968 and started with a company called Control Data, and got involved early on and understood technology. Moved to the Washington area in 1977 and started to work with a company called Control Data and got into computer technology for the government. And so I learned a lot about computers and technology, and that led me into getting more into the areas of education. And a group of us started a company that delivered educational services. And then from there, it just stayed with technology and got interested in all aspects of communications and telecommunications.
Right. So you've started and sold successfully a number of companies.
Yes.
And now you're running this.
Yes.
Why? How did all of that prepare you to do this thing really well, do you suppose?
Well, I think any business that you look at, business fundamentals apply across the board. But more importantly, it's the people and how you manage people and how you see people react to the environment they're in. And if you create the right environment with people, they will respond. So learning those interpersonal skills that are needed to run a business is quite important.
But your business is very unique in that your employees are disabled. They're blind. How did you deal with that when you first came on? How did you, address the unique situation of your employees?
I never looked at them as being blind. I looked at them as just being me, that they had the same intellect, the same intelligence, in some cases the same education. It's just that they couldn't see what they were looking at.
Yeah.
So you give them the fundamental tools, and we will function the same way.
Is this an opportunity to clear up a misconception we might have about blind folks? What would it be?
Well, I think it's not just blind people, it's people with disabilities, all kinds of disabilities, that when we look at the disability community, we think they can't perform at the level that you or I can perform at. And that's not correct. When you look at the community as a whole, they want to work, and they want to be like you and I and be productive and contribute to the bottom line. So you don't treat them any differently. In our environment, no one's treated any differently. It's productivity, it's time management, it's production, right. It's revenue, it's profit.
Where are you from, Tony?
South Philadelphia, Philadelphia area.
What were Mom and Dad doing when you were growing up?
Oh, my dad was in the fruit produce business, and my mother was a seamstress at a tailor shop.
What important life lessons were you learning at that time?
Family, how close we were. We lived in a community of other Italian families, and my grandmother and grandfather lived on the same street. My aunt and uncle lived around the corner. That unity of family was the big thing.
Yeah. Did you spend a lot of time with your grandparents?
Absolutely. My grandmother used to take care of me, and at one time I was fluent in Italian because she only spoke Italian.
What do you think you learned from your grandparents?
Hard work, family, community.
All right. What were you like as a kid?
Tough.
Say more.
Well, I had to learn how to live in an environment where your parents wanted you to be more than them. And so you had to get educated. You had to look good. You had to be respectful to your parents. So you had to learn all the basic skills of being a real human being.
You also did some boxing.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I didn't realize when I was growing up why I had all speed bags and sandbags in our basement, and why I had to watch Friday night fights with my father. And and he would be able to score the fights. And I said, how does he know to do this? And I was only like 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And then one day when I was getting to a point where he said, well, you know, I think you ought to start, a good lesson in life is you ought to learn how to use that speed bag. And also you ought to take the Joe Louis Championship Golden Glove program. So that's how I got involved.
How did your experiences with boxing and growing up, you know, tough, translate into your business skills?
Well, I think it made me more humble about how you treat people, because boxing is a pretty tough sport. But you learn, I think, respect for the other person, and you learn how to be very disciplined, because if you don't know where the next punch is coming, you're going to be on the canvas. So I think you learn a lot about business in the same way. You always have to be forward-thinking, mm-hmm. but be respectful to the people that work with you.
Right. What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished, personally or professionally?
I think my job now has been my toughest challenge, because we want to do so much to help the individual become independent. And there are so many. There are more than 300 million people in the world that are visually impaired and blind. And within this region, there's over 180,000. Is how do we touch every one of them? And that's my biggest challenge.
Mm. How about your proudest moment along the way?
It happens every day. When we see that we had just recently had a board meeting, and we had a presentation by one of our program directors that spoke of a person who is a veteran who had not been out of his house for 5 years. And he came to our program, and now he's riding the metro, he's cooking for himself. And every day it happens like that. So that I've had a lot of proud moments.
Right. Are your mom and dad aware of your success?
I think they looked at what I was accomplishing as a husband and a father with my children, because they didn't look at what I did for a living. They looked at my children and my wife.
Wonderful.
More than me.
What's the website address, Tony?
Oh, it's www.clb.org.
Great. One more time.
www.clb.org.
Great. We've been speaking with Tony Cancelosi, who is the president and CEO of Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. I'd like to thank my co-host today, David Dixon, with Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney, for helping me out with the interviews. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more information about our executive leaders. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Chris LeGrand, the president and CEO of Futures Group; David Steiner, the president D&R International; Bill Smedberg, the president of Pingtone Communications; and finally, Tony Cancelosi, who's the president and CEO of Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. I'd like to thank you, our listeners, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com, or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Celebrate summer at Safeway's Barbecue Battle, June 23rd and 24th on Pennsylvania Avenue. Benefiting the Boys and Girls Clubs, this great family event features free food samples, free kids rides, and activities like NBA Nation. Plus 30 bands on 3 stages. Hear Soul Asylum and a special tribute to the legendary godfather of go-go, Chuck Brown. For more information, call 202-829-3099 or visit bbqdc.com. We'll see you at the BBQ.
Share your home, change the world. Host a Youth for Understanding exchange student. Imagine welcoming a young person from Thailand, Japan, Germany, or one of 60 other countries into your family. Now everyday experiences take on a new and exciting twist. American traditions gain deeper meaning as you share them with your new son or daughter. Call 1-866-4-YFU-USA or visit the website at yfu-usa.org to learn how you can become a Youth for Understanding host family.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a
a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or